Hello, I'm Stephanie Gleason, senior reporter for The Deal, and you're listening to Fresh Start. On this podcast, we talk about issues and cases in Chapter 11. But today, we're going to talk about something that isn't a bankruptcy topic yet, but certainly will be in the future. Today, I'm thrilled to have Adam Levitin here to talk about crypto exchanges and what happens when one inevitably goes into bankruptcy. Adam is a professor at Georgetown Law, specializing in bankruptcy, commercial law, and financial regulation. He's the author of numerous papers, including a recent paper on this topic called Not Your Keys, Not Your Coins. And he has a professional announcement. Adam, thank you so much for being here. Can you tell us a little about it?
It's a pleasure to join you, Stephanie. I'm pleased to announce that I'm going to be joining with the Gordian Group, an investment bank focused on distressed situations, in a joint venture called Gordian Crypto that will focus on providing specialized distressed advisory services for the crypto industry. So for exactly the sort of situation we're going to be talking about today.
That's fantastic. Well, thank you so much for being here. I read your paper and I sort of already knew the headline, which is that crypto customers could be treated as unsecured creditors in the event of a bankruptcy. But your paper still really, I found it so interesting and I learned so many things I didn't know. I think it should be required reading for anyone who's going to invest in crypto. Maybe if you already had it, you wish you'd already read it. But it's such a big topic right now and there are a lot of things that I hadn't heard discussed other places. So why did you decide to tackle this, look into this topic?
So here's the backstory. I've been teaching a class called Law of Money since 2016. And it turns out that there's actually a tremendous amount of law, both constitutional and rather detailed statutory stuff about money. And in this day and age, you can't really teach about money without getting into cryptocurrencies. And not surprisingly, that's what students are generally really eager to talk about and they want to write papers about. And this has been on my sort of radar as an academic issue for a while. The immediate spur, though, was that it was a conversation I had with some staff at a federal regulatory agency that was just trying to get a handle on exactly what the risks would be in a bankruptcy situation. There's really not a lot of professional expertise about bankruptcy in federal regulatory agencies, because that's not what they deal with. Other than the United States Trustee Program, which is not really a regulatory agency, most agencies don't encounter bankruptcy very often. When they do, they're often not representing themselves in court. It's the U.S. Attorney's Office that will. So they have a need to look for some outside expertise. And in the course of this conversation with the agency's staff, it became apparent to me that there was a bunch of actually really interesting and thorny legal issues about the treatment of cryptocurrency in bankruptcy. And from there, I kind of worked out my thoughts initially as a blog post and then realized actually there's a broader article that could come out of that. And that turned into this Not Your Keys, Not Your Coins article.
Great. Well, I think that maybe it's helpful before we really dig into the thorny issues that you discuss to sort of lay out what it is that we're talking about. I think that crypto is such a popular topic right now. We hear a lot of these words thrown around, and I realized how important it is to understand exactly what they mean for this conversation and for understanding what might happen in a bankruptcy. So, for example, blockchain and mining, these are terms that I think people hear a lot, but maybe don't understand completely what they are. Could you give us an idea of what they mean?
Sure. Let's actually start with crypto. Crypto is a really broad term that can cover both what we might call cryptocurrencies, systems for accounting for value and transferring value, and also other types of assets, such as non-fungible tokens, and maybe even broader, we could talk maybe about Web3 or the metaverse. What we're focused on here are cryptocurrencies. And these are things like Bitcoin and Ethereum, and no one quite knows how to pronounce it, Dogecoin, the thing with the little Shiba Inu.
You know it when you see it.
Exactly. Cryptocurrencies also include the subset of cryptocurrencies called stable coins. And we'll get into what those are. So what makes something crypto deals with the way that value or rights to value in a cryptocurrency are tracked. The basic technology underlying any kind of cryptocurrency is a type of database called a blockchain. And you can, if you think of this by in contrast to, let's say, a bank's balance sheets or a bank's, or really a bank's books and records, you make a deposit at the bank and the bank records its liability to you for the deposit on its books and records. And that's just kept at the bank. No one else has a copy. You get, you know, a periodic statement with it, or maybe you have a passbook. I don't know if anyone uses those anymore. But that's how your rights are being tracked. It's just on the bank's own books and records. A blockchain is a type of distributed ledger so that all the different participants in a particular blockchain, so there's a Bitcoin blockchain, there is a separate Ethereum blockchain, every cryptocurrency has its own blockchain. And the ledger there, keeping track of who has what ownership interests, and I say ownership in quotations,
yeah,
just as shorthand, right? You know, whatever rights the thing gives out, whatever interests these are.
Right.
Those interests are tracked on a distributed ledger so that everyone in the system has, at least in theory, a copy of the ledger. So you can think of this as being like a shared Google spreadsheet, right? We're going to collaborate on a project with a spreadsheet, and we're all going to have access to it. The thing is, with a shared spreadsheet, well, if it's keeping track of balances, why am I not going to just make an edit and change the $1,000 that I am owed to $1,000,000, right? That's the concern. So we need a system that controls the editing. And what a blockchain is it's an append-only database. And different types of blockchains use different mechanisms for how you get to edit the database. And again, because it's append-only, you're just adding additional data on the end. The data that's added is a block, and it's a chain of blocks, and it's a blockchain. And every time you add a block, the chain is getting longer and longer. So every transaction that happens on the blockchain is recorded. And this means you can look at this transaction history back to the beginning of a blockchain. Okay, so we need a system within this blockchain, this with this distributed ledger, for ensuring that the edits that are made to the blockchain are legit. That if I transfer some Bitcoins to you, Stephanie, let's use Bitcoin as our example. Yes. If I transfer you some Bitcoins, we want that recorded on the blockchain, that my balance of Bitcoins is reduced and yours is increased. And the way that we do this, that the transaction is verified, is through a process called mining. And mining, I think the easiest way for a layperson to understand it is a race to solve a mathematical puzzle. The mathematical puzzle is a cryptographic puzzle, hence the crypto terminology. And it's kind of like just a bingo game. It's not that there that because what you have, when you and I each have a public key and a private key, and when I want to send Bitcoins to you, I need to authorize the transaction where I use my private key to indicate that I want to send the Bitcoins, and your public key kind of helps provide, gives me something that's sort of like, it's not the actual address on the blockchain, but it gives me something. So you put them together, you get something like an address. It says where they're being sent to. In order to verify that the private key is the real private key and the public key is the right one, you plug them into some kind of an algorithm. And if everything checks out, then the transaction goes through. And that checking out process is the mining, and it's done by just computing power. Now, different blockchains use different types of systems for the computing. The traditional one is what's called a proof of work system. That's what Bitcoin uses. That's what Ethereum currently uses. And those are the two biggest cryptocurrencies. Ethereum is in the midst of a transition to a different system called proof of stake. Here's the basic difference. Proof of work is a race. anyone who wants is allowed to mine Bitcoins. In other words, try and solve these algorithms to verify transactions. And why would you ever want to do this? Well, the first one to solve the algorithm gets a prize. And that prize is paid in Bitcoins. So a way you can make Bitcoins is by being a miner. And at this point, mining Bitcoins, it's such an arms race that if you want to get into this, you need enormous, enormous amounts of computing power, which of course takes a huge amount of electricity for powering and cooling the computers and the spaces that they're in. But at core, it's just computers playing bingo, right? It's whoever's computer gets bingo first wins and gets the coin, gets the reward. In contrast, a proof of stake system assigns the right to do the mining to whoever has the largest stake in the system. And the stake is basically the ownership pool. If you have the largest stake, you get the right to mine, and you have to mine something successfully within a limited time window. Otherwise, you don't not only do you not get the reward, you get penalized. It's called getting slashed. Right? You gotta love the terminology that's used in this stuff. So how do you assemble the largest pool? Well, it's not by actually owning the most of the cryptocurrency. It's that you borrow people's staking rights, because you have sort of you can separate out the staking right from other rights with the cryptocurrency, and you pay them something. You give them a cut of the reward in exchange for their staking right. So you get competing staking pools. The benefit of that is you don't have lots of computers all trying to sell the same problem with only one winner possible. So it's much more efficient environmentally.
Interesting. Yes. And so we have the blockchain and we have the mining, sort of a digital ledger, and the people who are trying to verify these transactions, or computers that are verifying these transactions. And then the next two things that are important to understand are wallets and exchanges. And so what is a wallet in this context, and how does that work into exchanges, which the topic of your paper really deals with what would happen if an exchange went bankrupt. So how do those things play into each other?
Well, if you own cryptocurrency, you need some way to hold it and access it. And it's all electronic. There's no physical thing, even though, you know, sometimes you'll see on the web some image of a coin with the B with kind of the lines through it, like kind of dollar sign lines. There's no actual coin for any of this stuff, right? That's just an artistic representation. So you need somewhere to electronically hold your cryptocurrency. And where you do that is a wallet. And a wallet can take a lot of different forms in terms of hardware. But at core, it's actually software, right? That you have for a wallet. It's going to have basically an address on the blockchain. And typically, a user will have not one, but multiple blockchain addresses. And you can think of a blockchain address as just looking kind of like an IP address. You know, it's a long alphanumeric string. And so you'll have your particular addresses on the wallet, and the wallet also generates the private key and provide the public key for you. So you can keep that wallet in a whole bunch of different forms. You can have it simply online, residing in the cloud somewhere. You can have it on a physical device that is not connected to the internet unless you take some step to connect it. You could, in theory, have it all written down just on a piece of paper, right? But if you ever wanted to transact, you have to bring this into an electronic format, and that electronic format has to be connected to the internet. So when you're transacting, you've got to go hot. You've got to be connected to the internet. When you're not transacting, you can keep it in a internet-connected form that's called a hot wallet, or you can keep it in a cold wallet, something that's not connected to the internet, or cold storage. The reason you might want to keep it in cold storage when you're not transacting is because it substantially reduces the risk of hacking, that anything that's connected to the internet has, in theory, some level of vulnerability. If I have just like a flash drive and that's not connected unless it's plugged into my computer or something, I don't have to worry about a hacker attacking it when it's not plugged in. So you can keep the wallet in any number of forms, but basically it's the software that will allow you to connect and interface with the blockchain. So because of the variety of forms of a wallet, you can buy just a standalone hardware wallet if you wanted. But what a lot of people do is they use a wallet that is provided by a cryptocurrency exchange. And they do this because it's the easiest way to do it. So let's turn to that. What is a cryptocurrency exchange?
Yes.
If you want to buy and sell crypto, you need to find someone on the other side of the transaction, right? So you and I might be just get to talking and discover, hey, you want to buy some Bitcoins and I want to sell them and we can agree on a price. Great. But almost everyone who invests in crypto is looking to invest in it as a speculative medium rather than a transacting medium. I'm not likely to buy a cup of coffee with crypto. Yes, you'll find some headlines where you can do this. Tesla might take crypto, but anyone who actually values crypto won't spend it. Right? This is what's called Gresham's Law, that bad money pushes out the good, that you will always spend the medium that you value less and hold on to the one you value more. So if you, this is back in the day, it was gold and silver. Gold didn't circulate because people valued it more. They would use silver as the transacting medium. And then if gold doesn't circulate, how do we know stuff is even worth, because they're not market transactions? Same thing. In theory, you can transact in this stuff, but almost no one does. So if I'm in this just for speculative purposes and for buying and selling, I really want to find the best execution possible on a trade. If I'm selling, I want to find all the possible buyers and find what the best offer is. And trying to do this bilaterally isn't going to get me there if I have to negotiate one-on-one. Instead, I want a marketplace which brings everyone together and has a system for coordinating bids and asks. And that's what an exchange does. It just provides a centralized marketplace. So take, for example, the Coinbase, which is one of the biggest US-based crypto exchanges. If I want to find people who want to buy Bitcoin, I can open up an account on Coinbase. And then I get all of Coinbase's asks and bids. I can see what the going price is on Coinbase. It doesn't get me access to the customers who are placing bids, say, on another exchange like Gemini, but I'm at least going to see the Coinbase ones. And, you know, it's like stock exchanges. But remember, when you have something like a stock exchange, there's also going to be a clearinghouse attached to it. So I sell you 100 shares of IBM. That's on the exchange part. But then we need some mechanism whereby I actually transfer those shares of IBM and you transfer the money to me. That's the clearinghouse. The cryptocurrency exchange kind of pushes them all into one thing. So it's going to be the marketplace where the buyers and sellers meet. It's also going to effectuate the transaction. Now, in theory, you and I, if we transact through an exchange through Coinbase, it could just record that transaction on the blockchain, that Adam has parted with one Bitcoin and Stephanie has bought one Bitcoin. But remember, that transaction on the blockchain, someone's got to get paid for that. The miners need a reward, and the mining reward gets generated by the blockchain. But if there's more demand for transactions than there are miners, we need to find some other way to incentivize them. And there are typically mining fees that get paid. Then if you want your transaction to be prioritized, you want it to go through in the next block, you're going to pay more. And that means the actual transaction cost of trade can get kind of high. So what's a solution for a company like Coinbase? It just says, well, we're just going to do this trade on us. It's just going to be on our books. We're going to credit Stephanie's account with a Bitcoin, and we're going to remove one from Adam's account. But none of that is necessarily going to be recorded on the blockchain.
Right. And we're not going to put it on the ledger. We're just going to do it on our own.
We're going to have this. It's not going to be on this distributed ledger. It's just going to be like a traditional financial institution on our own books and records. And by the way, you know, there's going to be some cost savings from this. Some of them might go to you and me, and some of them might get kept by Coinbase. Right. This is how at least some of the transactions are likely to go down. And this is one way an exchange makes money.
Right.
Okay. So the key thing for the exchange to do this, though, if it wants to bring you and me together, is we need to each have a wallet on the exchange. And I might use a separate hardware wallet that I keep in cold storage. But when I want to actually transact on the exchange, I'm going to need to move stuff from my wallet into a wallet that the exchange has some level of access to. And then let the exchange do the next part of the transaction itself. Now, what a lot of people do to make life easier for themselves is they just use an exchange provided wallet. They won't have a separate wallet. And you can think of this as like having a bank account, right? You deposit the money at the bank and that's fine, but we're in a very different regulatory world than with a bank. So if I deposit money at the bank, I of course expect that my money is going to be commingled with every other depositor's money at the bank. Right? I don't have a claim for a particular dollar bill with a particular serial number. Instead, I just have an unsecured claim on the bank. That differs from, let's say, a safe deposit, where if I put in some valuable gems in a safe deposit box, I have a claim to get back those specific valuable gems, not just a claim for, you know, value.
Some valuable gems.
Value, exactly. What often happens, you know, there are different arrangements are possible, but what often happens with the cryptocurrency exchange is when you open a wallet with them, they will transfer the cryptocurrency you have in that wallet into an omnibus account that they alone control. So you may have a notional account at the exchange, and it will, if you log on to the exchange, it will show your balance, but that's reflecting what's in the exchange's books and records. The exchange actually is the entity that now has control of that cryptocurrency with its own private key. And that's what tees up the potential bankruptcy problem.
Right. So most people probably think that if they have a wallet on an exchange, it's holding crypto that in some way belongs to them, but that's not exactly accurate.
That's right. So, and I think a lot of this is because people think of crypto by way of analogy to other assets. And the asset itself is a little different and the legal regimes are different. So if I have money at the, and let's take two other legal regimes before we can get to crypto. One is deposit of money at a bank. And with that, I don't have a specific claim on any money. I have a general unsecured claim, but I'm not going to worry about it because it's all entirely fungible. And by the way, it's FDIC insured. And the way FDIC resolutions work, depositors don't experience any liquidity interruption. The FDIC does the transition so fast and seamlessly that it doesn't cause problems for depositors in 99.9% of cases. Another variation is if you have securities that are held in a brokerage account. If a securities broker goes belly up, there is insurance on that. There's SIPC insurance.
And what is SIPC?
Securities Investor Protection Corporation. It's sort of the
similar FDIC to the
equivalent for securities. It doesn't guarantee, it's not protecting you from loss of market value on the securities. It's protecting you from the broker absconding with your funds or something like that. So with securities that are being held by a brokerage, you again don't have a claim for a particular security. It's not like, you know, I have a claim on a particular share of IBM stock. But if I had 100 shares of IBM stock held at the failed brokerage, I have now a claim for 100 shares of that stock or the value on a certain date. And whatever stock holdings that brokerage has, those are available to its customers and not to its other creditors. Basically, we prioritize brokerage customers over other unsecured creditors of the brokerage. So if the brokerage hasn't actually somehow lost the securities, I get my pro rata stake of the share of the IBM stock held by the brokerage. Yeah, I may have some liquidity disruptions, but fundamentally, I'm not at the back of the line. I'm not having to share with the brokerage's bondholders and employees and retirees and tort creditors and the tax authority. So it's not maybe ideal, but it's not the end of the world. In contrast, if you have a cryptocurrency exchange that is using an omnibus, that's holding the customer's cryptocurrency in an omnibus wallet controlled solely by the exchange, it's not entirely clear what the legal treatment would be. Now, let's start with this. Outside of the US, if you look at civil law countries, there's a lot of angst about whether cryptocurrency is even property. And to American lawyers, that's just like bizarre. How could this stuff not be property? We have a very capacious view of what can be property in the US. But in civil law countries, property has to fit into certain limited defined buckets. And if it doesn't fit in one of those buckets, it's not property. And if it's not property, then it certainly can't be the customer's property in any form. And where we've seen this issue play out has mainly been in civil law jurisdictions. Now, we haven't seen this play out in the U.S. But in the U.S., there are a few different possibilities of how you might characterize custodially held cryptocurrency.
So this is in a scenario where an exchange has filed for bankruptcy, and now we're trying to figure out they have the custodial assets. And who do they belong to?
Who do they belong to? And let's actually start with why this matters. If the custodial assets are property of the customers, the exchange has to hand them over to the customers. How quickly and smoothly that will happen, we can't say. But they belong to the customers. You can't hold on to someone else's stuff. The customers might still have to go to court, seek an order to have the automatic stay lifted just to be sure. And if it's lifted, then they may have to, you know, if the exchange isn't cooperating, they may have to file a Rep. Levin action or something, but they can get them back. Right? There's some liquidity disruption, most likely, but you're not having to share your coins with anyone.
And that's the way it plays out in a broker bankruptcy.
That's right.
Largely.
Basically. In contrast, if these coins belong to the cryptocurrency exchange, then the exchange's customers are just general unsecured creditors. They're going to have to share pro rata with all of the other unsecured creditors for the assets of the exchange that are left over after the secured claims have been paid and the whatever priority expenses, particularly the administrative expenses of the bankruptcy. And who knows when that's going to get paid.
And so they become property of the estate, as we would say.
Exactly. That's what they would be. Property of the estate, and the customers are just general unsecured creditors. So which are they? That's the question.
So can you lay out the ways that these claims could be treated in bankruptcy if they're property of the estate?
Well, they could be property of the estate through a number of different characterizations. First, it's possible that they are held in express trust for the cryptocurrency exchange customers. I don't think that's likely, given that I have not seen any cryptocurrency exchange agreement that has language that would trigger the creation of an express trust. But in theory, that is one way that they could be held. And I think we can talk a little later about what we might call a staged wallet, where there may be a express trust on top of another omnibus wallet. But at least as far as we can tell from public documents, it doesn't seem like any of these assets are being held in an express trust. Second possibility is that they could be held in a constructive trust. This is a state law matter. A lot of states basically, you know, state law and constructive trust is all over the place, but it is generally not a status that's going to be recognized in bankruptcy if there has not already been a state law judgment creating a constructive trust. A third possibility is that these are financial assets, and that's a term of art, financial assets, that are governed by Article 8 of the Uniform Commercial Code. If Article 8 applies, then all of the cryptocurrency held by the exchange is basically in something like a constructive trust for its customers, that the exchange's other unsecured creditors do not have any claim on that cryptocurrency. Instead, the cryptocurrency depositors would have a pro rata claim on the cryptocurrency that the exchange holds. Now, it's important to note, if I have deposited Bitcoin with the exchange, I don't have a pro rata claim on its holdings of Ethereum, but I'm just going to have a pro rata claim on its holdings of Bitcoin. But none of the unsecured creditors of the exchange will be able to have any kind of claim on those cryptocurrency holdings. Those would all be for the cryptocurrency depositors. That's if Article 8 applies. Now, whether Article 8 applies is a complex question, but the easiest way to answer it is if an exchange's user agreement says Article 8 applies, then Article 8 applies. As it happens, I've only seen a single U.S. cryptocurrency exchange that invokes Article 8. That's Coinbase, and it only started doing so on June 1st of this year. Previously, Coinbase was not under Article 8.
And in fact, they had said the opposite a few months before, right?
That's right. And I would like to take a little bit of credit. Maybe I should send them a bill for the free legal advice, because Coinbase's change in its user agreement came out just a few days after I posted a revised version of the article that had an extended discussion about Article 8 treatment and noted that no exchange at the time was invoking Article 8. It may just be coincidence, but I'm skeptical. There's two other possible treatments of the custodial cryptocurrency. So we've seen it might, you know, in theory could be an express trust or constructive trust. That's unlikely. It could be governed by Article 8 of the UCC, but that is usually going to require express invocation of Article 8, given the way some other Article 8 definitions work. But there's some legal fuzziness there, I'll be the first to say. The fourth possibility is that the custodially held cryptocurrency is a bailment. And what's a bailment? A bailment is when you hold property for someone else and you are not holding legal title to it. You just are holding possession of it. So this is like a parking valet or a coat check, right? You give your coat over to the coat check. The coat check doesn't own the property. It's not like a trust where they'd have legal title to the property. They just are holding possession for you, and that's it. And they're not entitled to go and do things with the bailment. So if you remember Ferris Bueller's Day Off, Ferris borrows his friend's dad's Ferrari, takes it out on for a fun day in Chicago, and leaves it in a garage, and the parking valet goes off on a joyride. You can't do that if you're with a bailment. If it's a bailment, the bailed property is not going to be property of the estate. Right? The estate's interest would be limited to the bailment interest and nothing more. And basically, the estate would have to hand over the property to the cryptocurrency depositors. The problem is that a bailment is sometimes rather hard to distinguish from the fifth type of treatment, which is a sale. And you might say, how is that possible? No one would think that the coat check valet actually owns my coat, right? But suppose that you let the coat check valet wear your coat and that you let your coat check valet loan out your coat and start exercising all kinds of characteristics that go with ownership. In that situation, the relationship might be actually characterized as a sale rather than a bailment. And this gets particularly problematic when there is commingled property. So that's not a situation that's going to arise with a coat check or with a parking valet. But when my cryptocurrency is mingled in an omnibus account with your cryptocurrency, then it's a little harder to say that there's a bailment, where typical bailment, you have to give back exactly what you got. And when assets get commingled, it's kind of hard to do that. Now, the law of bailments is frankly a mess. There are some very clear 19th century Supreme Court cases, but those are federal common law cases that, you know, don't control anymore. And more recent cases, you have some cases where you have commingled property with, let's say, precious metals. We saw this in the Miami Metals bankruptcy fairly recently, where the court says, yeah, it's commingled. I am going to look at this as a sale, and therefore it's property of the estate. But you also have some oil and gas pipeline cases where oil and gas gets commingled in the pipeline, and courts have said, well, of course it's commingled in the pipeline. That's how oil and gas works. That doesn't defeat a bailment. And I'm not sure quite how to make heads or tails out of this. And I think that's maybe the key point. The property characterization of custodially held cryptocurrency is uncertain unless the exchange expressly opts into Article 8 coverage. If it doesn't, then I don't think anyone can say with certainty how a bankruptcy court would characterize the relationship. And that should be of concern to cryptocurrency exchange customers, because at the very least, it means a lot of delay in litigation. And it could very well be that their custodially held assets are actually property of the estate.
Right. It seemed one of your main points in the article was that we don't know how they will be treated or how they'll be classified in a bankruptcy. But we do know that it will for sure be contested. And at the very least, that is going to be difficult for the customers and burdensome on them, right?
I think that's right. And, you know, lurking in the background of this is, I think, maybe a ethics problem for, let's say, an official committee, where the official committee needs to get paid, and to get paid, the estate needs to have assets. And you can imagine an official committee having an incentive to say these are property of the estate because that's where our fees are going to come out of. On the other hand, the interest of the creditors being represented by the official committee might be that these aren't actually property of the estate and that they're not really creditors. It's just their property that the estate happens to be holding on to right now. So that could get kind of messy.
Yeah, you also point out that it's just very unlikely that the crypto investors understand all of these distinctions in the event of a bankruptcy, which isn't something you necessarily think of as a traditional problem for investors that are involved in a bankruptcy, but that's not the case here.
No, this is particularly with retail investors, and there's been a big push in the last couple of years for crypto to kind of expand its retail focus. Retail investors are unlikely to understand any of this. That your typical layperson has virtually no understanding of bankruptcy in the first place. So I think this kind of creates a parallel to the situation we have with bank deposits and securities brokerages, where we have public laws that create some protections because sort of the assumption behind the laws is your retail investors aren't going to be as quick and savvy about all the risks, and they need mandatory protections because without them, they're going to get fleeced.
Right. There is a reason, for example, the SIPA Act came into place. You know, there was a time when that didn't exist as a protection for investors, but now they have this protection. There's one more thing that you get into that's a technical part of bankruptcy that I thought was very interesting in terms of how a bankruptcy of an exchange could play out, which is that in bankruptcy, there are preference actions, the ability to claw back certain assets that have been transferred in the period before a bankruptcy filing. And so the scenario that came to mind for me was that perhaps there's rumors in the lead up to an exchange filing for bankruptcy, and some of the customers decide to sell their crypto assets before the filing and think, oh, phew, I dodged a bullet there. I won't be involved. But that's not necessarily the case, right?
Yeah, there's the possibility that transfers, like redemptions of cryptocurrency, might be voidable preferences because there'd be transfers to or for the benefit of an unsecured creditor during the preference period when we're going to presume insolvency. And if that customer would do better than in a hypothetical Chapter 7 liquidation without the transfer, that gives you a preference. Now, whether that preference is subject to one of the numerous defenses to preferences is another question. And that's going to depend on the particular facts. But the one that leaps to mind would be there's an ordinary course defense to preferences. But if you have someone who's been holding their cryptocurrency for years and years and all of a sudden does a redemption, I'm not so sure that they're going to benefit from the ordinary course defense.
So if it was clawed back, how would that work?
The mechanics of the clawback will absolutely present some challenges. Presumably, you know, at the end of the day, if there's a successful preference action, there's a court order to return the assets. And one of the key questions is going to be whether it's the actual assets that have to be returned or just their market value. And if it's their market value, the question then is the market value as of what date? Because there's going to be market movements in the price of the cryptocurrency. Depending on how those market movements go, it could end up being quite costly for the customer. They may have to basically bear the market risk with the preference. I think the key point with this, Stephanie, though, is it's really not clear how all of this is going to play out. And that should be the single biggest concern of cryptocurrency customers, is that they don't know how this is going to play out. And therefore, they can't price this risk. That if this stuff is property of the estate, then they're going to be unsecured customers, but they can't tell if it's going to be property of the estate or not. If it's not property of the estate, they'll get their property back, but they don't know when. And they will certainly be exposed to market swings in the interim when they are not liquid. And then even if it is not property estate, the cryptocurrency customers are always vulnerable to there being shortfalls in custodial holdings. And that would be a major reason why a cryptocurrency exchange might fail. If a cryptocurrency exchange is hacked and loses tens or hundreds of millions of dollars of a cryptocurrency, it won't matter that that's property of the customers, because the exchange can't give them their property back in full. And the deficiency will just be an unsecured claim. So this uncertainty about how, whether it's going to be property of the estate, whether there are going to actually be enough assets, even if it's not property of the estate, and then about how preference law would be applied. And I should add in on the preference law side, there's also the question about whether these are securities or commodities transactions. If they are, there can be an additional possible defense to it being a preference, but how any particular cryptocurrency is characterized, whether it's a security, commodity, or something else, that's a separate matter of a lot of debate.
I know a popular way more recently to own crypto has been through companies like Venmo, where you can keep a wallet now. And so maybe they're thinking, well, all of this is fine, but I don't think a company like Venmo is likely to file for bankruptcy, so I feel fine. Are there risks with something like that?
There's certainly risks there too. It's not that there's zero credit risk. So if you use Venmo, Venmo has what's called a staged wallet structure. You open an account with Venmo, but Venmo is not the custodian for your actual cryptocurrency. Instead, Venmo contracts out with a company called Paxos, which is structured as a New York limited purpose trust company. And Paxos holds the cryptocurrency in trust. But the real question is, who does it hold it in trust for? And it certainly is possible that Paxos holds it in trust for Venmo's customers, as reflected on Venmo's books and records. But we don't know that. It's also possible that Paxos holds the cryptocurrency in trust for Venmo itself. And if it's the latter, then if Paxos were to run into trouble, the Venmo's customers have no recourse against Paxos. They're not anything. They have no standing vis-a-vis Paxos. The only kind of claim they would have would be against Venmo. If Venmo is able to cover the losses, they're fine. If Venmo isn't, then there's a problem, but they would only be unsecured creditors of Venmo, and they would have no property claim for the actual cryptocurrency.
And is this a potential problem for Venmo or other companies that use these staged wallets?
You know, it means that if Venmo's taking on counterparty risk of its custodian, it probably is not a substantial risk, but there is some level of counterparty risk there. That if Venmo's custodian loses the cryptocurrency, it gets hacked, then Venmo would be on the hook for that difference to its customers as an unsecured claim. If Venmo were the custodian itself, there would be a hacking risk. It's just that Venmo might have a little more control over protecting against that hacking risk.
So broadly speaking, what is your takeaway from the risks associated with an exchange? Is there a way to safely invest in crypto on an exchange, or is it just that you're so vulnerable in the event of a bankruptcy that it's better to avoid or find a different way?
Well, let me start with saying I'm not urging anyone to invest in crypto. Your investment decisions are your own investment decisions. If you are doing this, however, it's about degrees of safety. There is no absolute safe solution here. It's just that there are some solutions that are safer than others, and that I would urge customers to be aware of what the risks are and try and seek out the safest options. And probably the safest options are using an exchange that clearly designates the cryptocurrency as being financial assets governed by Article 8 of the UCC. And if the custodian itself is either a New York limited purpose trust company or a Wyoming special purpose depository institution, that should probably relieve you of any concern that the custodian itself is rehypothecating your cryptocurrency, doing things like that. Some exchanges will offer the possibility of having your cryptocurrency held in a segregated account, not being put in an omnibus account. They charge extra for it, though. Whether that is a fee that is worthwhile paying for the risk, that's, you know, I'm not sure. But if you're concerned about the risk, that you might think that's worthwhile. Having a segregated account certainly gives you some more protection. It doesn't guarantee that it's not property of the estate. I think the best approach would be if Article 8 of the UCC governs, then that you know you have a property interest rather than a contract claim.
Is that what you think broadly could be done most easily to fix much of this confusion, is adding that into the user language or agreement language?
Yes, and that could be done tomorrow by every exchange that does business in the US. It doesn't require new legislation. It could be, you know, that's just a change in the user agreement. And, you know, I think Coinbase did the right thing by its customers by amending its user agreement to have Article 8 apply. I think that was the right move. I would hope to see other exchanges do that. But I do want to emphasize, even if Article 8 applies, it's not that it relieves customers of all risks. It makes it safer. It does not make it safe, right? There is still always going to be a level of liquidity risk, and there's going to be a level of risk for shortfalls in custodial holdings. There's no way around the risk that an exchange gets hacked and it just doesn't have enough of the custodially held cryptocurrency to satisfy all customer rights.
And so that would be an easy fix. Are there other perhaps regulatory changes being considered?
Absolutely. So just this week, Senators Lummis from Wyoming and Gillibrand from New York introduced a bill to sort of do a general regulation of the cryptocurrency industry. And among the provisions of the bill, it would clarify that cryptocurrency exchanges, if they go into bankruptcy, would be treated as commodity exchanges and subject to the commodity broker liquidation provisions of Chapter 7. The effect of applying those provisions ends up looking pretty much like the application of Article 8, that the custodially held cryptocurrency would be treated as customer property rather than property of the estate, and unsecured creditors of the exchange would not have a claim on the custodially held cryptocurrency.
Well, Adam, I really appreciate you talking us through the nuances of this. It's such an interesting topic and so important for anyone who's interested in cryptocurrency or bankruptcy. So it's been really great to have you here. I appreciate you coming on and explaining this to us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure talking with you, Stephanie. You know, we haven't seen any cryptocurrency exchanges go into bankruptcy in the US yet, but it's become a large enough industry where you have enough companies in the crypto space running into financial problems for one reason or another that the bankruptcy community is going to have to get up to speed on the issues that arise with cryptocurrency interacting with bankruptcy. And I think the sooner we start thinking about it, the better.
Absolutely. I'm Stephanie Gleason, and you've been listening to Fresh Start.